Welcome to What CEOs Talk About. Do you wonder what CEOs talk about behind closed doors? How they bring their vision to reality? How do they overcome and succeed through adversity? We share that and so much more with each episode. Now, let's get started with the show.
Hello, everybody. My name is Martin Hunter. Yes, it is me. Although my voice is crackling, I had to cancel a few recordings this week. But today we're back on track. I'm the host of What CEOs Talk About, where we translate vision into frontline strategies. Today, it's all about love and people. I'm so excited about talking about this subject. Mauro, thank you so very much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
Mauro, for the sake of the listeners, what is your name, rank, serial number? What do you do for a living currently?
Mauro Porcini. I am the Chief Design Officer and Senior Vice President of PepsiCo. I'm also the author of a book called The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People in Love with People. Italian, living in New York City and working with teams in 15 locations around the world, trying to drive innovation and branding with a human-centered approach in a big corporation like PepsiCo.
That is amazing. And you kind of gave a little bit of insight. What is the title of the show? Because Mauro has been thinking about this, how long, you said, for years for the title of your book, right?
Yes. Yes. The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People in Love with People. Somehow it summarized probably my life in general, but people may think, who cares about Mauro's life? And they're right. But it summarized an approach to business, to innovation, to create value for people and society through our products and brands that work pretty well for a company like PepsiCo, for a company like 3M, the tech company from Minnesota, before PepsiCo, and somehow probably can work well for any company out there, big or small. This human centricity is needed more than ever in this new global tech-driven digital society we live in.
I could not agree more on that. As I mean, anybody who's listened to the show, I mean, the boat is important. The company is important. When you put people first, I mean, there is still not one organization that is fully automated. There's decision-making, there's love, there's anyways. We're going to dive into that. For those people who are listening and not watching, behind Mauro's left shoulder, this must be the place, a little neon sign. I just absolutely love that sign in the back of your office. It actually super cool. Anyways, for the benefit of the
I love it too, because it can be interpreted in any way you want. I do so many meetings out of this room in my house, and I'm sure that people have different kind of feelings in this meeting. You know, sometimes there is the pressure of a delivery for a project. Sometimes there is the inspiration for something I say connected to the idea of love. Everybody interacting with me, but everybody interacting with you, with anybody listening to us right now, will have different kind of feelings when they interact with you. And so this must be the place, you know, it can be anything for all of you. This must be the place of pain. This must be the place of fun, of joy, of love, or God knows what else. So yeah.
I absolutely adore it. I mean, the PepsiCo sign with the two people holding it, there's, you look at their faces and they're, you know, we talk about the title of love, and it's like the way that they're holding it, the way that they're doing it is absolutely delightful as well. There's a good innovation and creativity that's attached to that. Oh, can you please tell us your story? Where were you born? Where did you grow up? How this individual become the
chief design officer. But yes, I work in creativity and innovation for sure in the company.
Absolutely. So can you please tell us your journey? Because I'm sure that it is exciting and full of ups and downs.
Well, I come from a town about 1 hour driving from Milan called Varese, from a very humble family. Myself, my brother, and my parents, I grew up sleeping in one bedroom with the four of us, and with parents that were obsessed with two ideas, the idea of culture and knowledge and knowing things, and the idea of kindness, of being good human beings, of being good people. And when I say obsessed, that means that they were practicing every day, they were talking about this, but they were never pressuring too much us, you know, in those dimensions. It was just that as a kid, you would observe them and you'd think that was just normal. That's the way of living life. That's what everybody should be. And so I grew up with that. They didn't think that fame or wealth were actually something positive, something, you know, that should be a goal in life. Mm-hmm. They feared somehow fame and wealth. And for instance, when I started to earn some money, not too much, you know, with my first jobs, you know, something more than average, I remember my mom being afraid that I could lose my value, I could lose my way. So this is the kind of family I grew up from. And then a family that was in love with art and writing and literature. My father is an architect and a high school professor back then. Now he's retired, but he's been painting all his life. And still today in his 80s, he keeps painting and painting and painting every day. My mom was working in finance. She hated finance. She left her job when she was 38 to stay close to the family. And we didn't have really money to afford something like this, but she just followed her passion. Her passion were her children, her family, and then writing. She would write every day for herself out of passion, out of love. And they, over the years, they self-published online 8 books that are physical books, but for themselves. They have zero interest promoting these books and selling these books. They sell here and there, but they made them, for their passion of doing it, and somehow to leave something behind for their kids, for their families, for the people that love them. And so why I'm saying all of this? Because I grew up with a family that made me fall in love with the idea, first of all, of loving what you do.
Yes.
Having a passion and spending time and investing time in doing that. And then with specific values that were the value of culture and the value of kindness that have been somehow a pillar of everything that happened to me in all these years. And the beginning were just intuitive values that I had inside because that's how my family educated me. But then over the years, looking back and what was working and what really helped me achieving certain positions and certain successes in what I was doing were also those values, were things that nobody ever talks about. Mm-hmm. We all talk about other things. And in reality, you know, those values made the difference for me. So the book actually talk about this, how things that you don't expect, like kindness, curiosity, optimism, actually can change the way you drive innovation in an organization.
Right? So you're in Italy. You grew up. You went to high school, I'm assuming, in Italy when you started working as a young man. When did you start developing? So what did you start off as? What kind of trade? And how did you kind of wind up in that innovation creation world?
Look, I studied design in university. I wanted to be a writer or eventually an artist. I ended up being a designer for a simple, very pragmatic reason. Back then in Italy, there were not many jobs, you know, as an artist or as a writer. And as soon as I was going to be out of college, I needed to sustain myself, to have an income. And so out of pragmatism, I decided to actually study architecture. And then a few weeks before the exam to try to enter the University of Architecture, a friend of mine called me and told me, you know, that within architecture, they created a new faculty called industrial design. Mm-hmm. And so these two worlds were kind of intriguing. Design on one side was talking to my humanistic passion for art and creativity. Mm-hmm. And industrial was talking to the more pragmatic need of creating you know, of having an income and having a living, you know. And so I was like, it could be interesting. So I tried, you know, the exam for the university. I write first out of thousands of different, you know, of people. I was like, wow, this must be my, you know, path.
Calling, yeah.
And so I start, and in a few months, I realized what design was really about. And I had no clue before. It was beautiful. I think it's one of the most beautiful professions in the world because it's all about studying people, their needs, their wants, their emotions, their ways of living and behaving, and then creating solutions for those needs and wants. It could be a product, a brand, a service, even a business. That's what designers do. And they are inventors, they're innovators, they change the world. I had no idea that there was a school teaching something like this. So that's how I started in the world of design. I get my master's degree in design with a thesis on wearable technologies. Oh. So the future of technology you can wear, thinking about 20 years or 30 years, you know, in advance
road, yeah.
About what technology could be. So technology that you wear for comfort, for safety, for connectivity, for security. And then I start working on that in Philips Design, in the Philips Consumer Electronics Company. I stay there about 1 year, and then I meet a big Italian celebrity. Imagine like meeting Jay-Z or Beyoncé here in the United States. The guy was a DJ, he was a singer, he was a producer of many other big celebrities that he found and he launched over the years in Italy. And in those years, he was intrigued by the world of internet, it was starting, and the digital world in general. And so I met him through a friend of a friend. And instead of just going, I was 24, instead of just going to get an autograph, and that's it. Or today, you go to get a selfie.
Can't get a selfie, I was going to say.
I went thinking, what can I do with him? And I went together with a couple of friends of mine to proposing actually to do a business, I mean, a project, not a business together, a project. We were just out of school. We would master the latest technologies in 3D modeling. And so we offer him the idea of using 3D modeling in internet sites. Essentially, the idea, the intuition was the one of what today we call the metaverse, without having the technologies we have today. But the idea that you could navigate internet as a city, you would enter in a physical space created digitally. And the guy, I think he saw the creativity of these young kids. And we, you know, he was a great talent scout. So he didn't have the arrogance of thinking, I figure out everything. He actually was curious about people with different ideas, different kind of skills. So long story short, he asked us, what do you do for a living? We lied, literally. We told him, well, we want to build a company, a studio together. And he told us, do it with me. And so a month later, we're signing with him, starting to work in this wonderful place in Milan with a, you know, it was his big house and office with a pool, with a studio, recording studio. I mean, incredible for a kid coming from a small town outside of Milan with zero connection, no money, sleeping all in one room. All of a sudden, you have all of this. It was magic. And we started, and that company lasts 2 years and a half. And then we closed. The internet bubble burst. It was not possible if you didn't have a fund behind to survive. It was early 2000. But it's interesting that just recently I realized that actually there was a failure. You open a company, you close because it didn't work out. I never, ever, 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 until few, literally weeks ago, saw that as a failure. I always look at that as an amazing experience where I learned so much from this guy. This guy taught me to be an innovator without ever, ever, ever using the word innovation. And so, and in the book, I have an entire chapter dedicated to him and how he became what I call, in this case, a mentor by osmosis, a mentor without realizing to be a mentor. Somebody that was behaving in a certain way, if your mind and soul are open enough, you can absorb and learn, but you need that kind of curiosity to understand what is this guy offering? What is doing differently? What you can learn out of his behaviors? But long story short, we close. I end up in 3M, the tech company from Minnesota, 3M, but in Milan. And I spent 10 years there, and I moved from being a design coordinator for the consumer business in Europe. The consumer business is one of the six businesses of the company, to become the chief design officer of the company. I moved to the United States. I got to live in Minnesota. And I then, 10 years ago, received the call of PepsiCo together with a variety of other companies. And I decide to go to PepsiCo and start that new journey that led me to where I am today.
What a jump from Milan to Minnesota. They both start with M, but oh my goodness, talk about a cultural difference and change. There's a couple of things that I want to pinpoint to the listeners. Mauro said, we lied. You didn't lie. You sold your vision, right? You sold the gentleman the vision of, hey, this is what I want to be. And when you're in your 20s, you said, right? There's vigor, enthusiasm. When you're my age, I'm 51 now, and I still think the same way. Is how do I see myself in the future? How do I create? How do I want something so bad that I can touch it, feel it, live in it? And it's not a matter of age. But we often see it in very young people, and we kind of stifle it through maturity. And we say, oh, you need to provide, you need to do this. But yet, when you look at young children and young adults who see a vision of themselves, I want this, I want that. That is so energetic and beautiful and creative on its own, right? We think of spring, summer is beautiful. But when the first flowers come, when you see them grow, there's a little bit something extra. So I loved how Mauro really went and said, well, hey, listen, we want to have a studio. Like you sold it a little bit. Yeah, you lied a little bit. But hey, listen, it brought you to a place. And the second component of that I think is beautiful is that it took you all these years because your mindset was not of success or failure, was of the journey. And I think that when you did close the business, it's just a natural chapter. It's people, we always think linear when we should think seasonal, right? I lived in the South Pacific for many years, and at a certain time I missed the seasons because it was always green. The flowers were always there. And so you kind of walked by and you said, coconuts and all this. And you don't realize how beautiful it is when you come back to Canada and you go into minus 30 or you go to Europe and there's seasons and you go, oh, wow, there's time, there's cyclical changes that is what's beautiful, I think. Yeah. So thank you very much for sharing that.
Now, you also say something very important that I talk extensively about in the book, and this idea of the dream. You're right. In the book, when I talk about the specific episode and what happened in the moment, I don't use the word lie because it was not. It just came out. Actually, it's the first time I used that word in that situation to describe that situation. What I say is that somehow one of us say, we want to create a studio together. And then I say in the book that probably what happened is that we all had that dream. We all had that desire, but then nobody ever said it loud. And then somebody said it, and then it became normal for all of us because we always thought that we wanted to do that. So I describe exactly like this, what you correctly interpreted as a dream. And then there is a specific part of the book where I talk about these 24 different characteristics of these incredible innovators. And one of the first ones, one of the very important one, is that ability to dream. You know, we are all born with that ability. As children, we dream, we fantasize, and then society try to normalize us, to stop us from dreaming. They tell us that dreaming is childish, but then we still, anyway, are able to protect that dream for a few years. You know, we arrive to college, and we're still dreaming. We get out of college, we go to these companies, and we're like, yes, we are going to change the world. We're going to change this company. We have so many aspirations, and we want to do so many things. And then we meet people in these companies that tell us, no, you can't. It's so naive to dream. How arrogant are you to think that you can change this company, you can change the world, you can change this product, you can change anything? Because society is not people, it's society that try to normalize us. Mm-hmm. Society doesn't want to have too many people dreaming. They prefer an army of people somehow, you know, aligned towards certain kind of standards. And so this is the world we live in, and we need to protect instead that ability to dream, you know, in all possible ways. Now, the few people that are able to keep dreaming, they need to understand that even that is not enough, though. You need to be able also to translate those dreams into action, in reality, in something that happened. And therefore, when you do that, you need to understand that you need to take compromises. You need to be able to take trade-offs, but they're still part of the dream. You're not touching the integrity of the dream. The dream is a long-term plan, and you need to understand how to walk towards the long-term plan, realizing that you can't realize an ambitious dream from night to day, and that, you know, it's okay to take steps towards that dream. But again, to do that, you need a series of other characteristics of these innovators, these unicorns, as I like to call them: curiosity, resilience, optimism, kindness, a series of traits that often companies don't talk about and are so important, and they make all the difference of the world.
It's in Japan. So I spent a few years in Japan, and there's a Japanese saying that says, vision without action is a dream, but action without vision is a nightmare. And so often at times, right, you're in the day-to-day grind, you're acting, but you're not working towards your dream and or desire. So therefore, you're in a living nightmare when you think about it. And so, I mean, when you and I grew up, people would retire at the age of 50, somewhere around there, right? Our parents used to retire. They'd work for the same company for, you know, 30 years. They'd retire at 50, and they'd die by the time they're 65. Because, you know, they didn't have. And now you have an older generation that lives their dreams, and they go, oh, I'm going to start living because now I'm in the retirement phase of and dreaming my part. Anyways, the point that I'm trying to make here is, Mauro's, when I started, I grew up poor as well. And I joined karate because I had anger issues. My dad was an alcoholic and I had serious anger issues. And so there was a gentleman who took me in, and I didn't have to pay for karate yet. There is a little woodblock painting. He says, oh, that's an island in Japan. And so I took it from a box of noodles, like ramen noodles. And I say, oh, that's really pretty. I kept it in my wallet. I still have it in my wallet upstairs. I went to Japan and took a sabbatical, went to Japan. I said, it's my time. I have money now. I need to spend time for me. Went to Japan. Some of the friends that I made over there said, oh, you have to go to this island. So you go to the island. It's not too far away from Tokyo, Inoshima. And I go through the island, and at the end, they have these little shops. And I look in one of the shops, and they have the replicated little woodblock painting that I've been carrying for 15 years in my back pocket. Tears came running down my face. And he says, it just shows that the destination is not as important as the journey. All these years, I say, oh, I wish I was there. I wish I was there. I wish I was there. But every day I moved my journey through martial arts, kendo, karate, aikido, moving my martial arts closer, closer, and closer to being serendipitously put in that position where you say, oh, wow. And so the event is not as important as the journey. And I think that's what we've stifled is that desire to want. It's okay for a grown man to say, I want a boat. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong. And I think that when we do have children, for those who are lucky enough and have children, I think that we relive that with children, you relive that beauty of wanting, of desiring. Anyways, I'm kind of going down a path, but you hit a really solid point for me anyways.
No, I agree so much. You know, there is so much literature that talk about the power of the journey. The writer Paulo Coelho, for instance, I mean, in his beautiful books, reiterate this idea so much. I talk actually about this in the book as well. There is this Italian poet, his name is Giacomo Leopardi from the 1800s, that talks about, I mean, there is a poem, specifically a poem, mm-hmm. called The Saturday in the Village, Il Sabato del Villaggio. And essentially, it's a short poem where he celebrates the joy that there is in the preparation of the Sunday party, the Sunday celebration. Oh, yeah, you know, and essentially, the poem is, the meaning is, there is so much joy in the journey of preparation where we connect and we work together and we have fun. And then the Sunday arrives, and yes, you're already starting to think about the Monday and the week after. But the joy that you had in the Saturday, thinking about, you know, the arrival at that point, but the joy was in the journey. And often you don't realize, because you think that the apex of the joy will be when you achieve that moment, but it's not. When recently a journalist asked me how I relate to the idea of joy and the idea of pride for specific achievements. And my answer was, I love, you know, the idea of the pride for something you achieve. And, you know, it's great. You achieve it. You're proud of it. It's there. But what I love the most is the joy of the journey to get there. And that's so beautiful. In fact, I am restless. And I always, you know, as soon as I see that I'm about to achieve a goal that I had, I'm already thinking about the next goal. Because I don't want to find myself in the situation of reaching the goal and having any form of gap without feeling the joy of the journey. And so it's a never-ending journey to achieve something that is always bigger and bigger. And by the way, the bigger and bigger is not at all about success or fame or wealth. The bigger and bigger is all about impacting the world.
Yes,
impacting the life of people with something that I do, I believe in.
I coach rugby. And I coach so little ones and adults. And every time, every year, they go, oh, well, why are you taking on more people to coach? Well, I said, you know, look at the impact that I've had with 25 young women, 14-year-old girls, 16-year-old girls. Now it's going to be 18-year-old girls. And so the impact that I've had is very selfish when you think about it. It's what's in it for me? What brings me joy that Mauro says so well? It's not about how much success that I want to have. It's you want to be almost more happy. It's just you want to keep that happy feeling. Because I was there last year. I achieved pretty much everything that I wanted to achieve by the time I was 50. And from 50 to 51, I was struggling because I could not find goals that were attractive to me. I don't want to say it was a horrible year, but it was a very difficult year. I have a beautiful house. My wife and my kids are healthy. They're happy. My business is flourishing. I had a podcast. I was coaching rugby. I was like, why are you being so selfish? Why do you want more? But it's that mindset, Mauro, that you said. It's like, it's not about wanting more. It's how can I do more? Which was very, very different. I want to bring it to the title because I really want to. Took you 15 years to get to that title. We've been recording for a while now. I'm really curious. How do you connect creativity and the love of people? Because that's going to be beautiful in itself, I believe.
Look, let's start from the subtitle, People in Love with People. There are three dimensions here. One is the second set of people, the people we love. With that word placed in that part of the sentence, I refer to the need of being human-centered in everything we do in these companies, of putting people before technologies, market share, profit, branding, seeing everything as an enabler, as an amplifier, eventually as a result, but really building a culture where you have every person in your company, marketer, designers, scientists and researchers, everybody thinking, how can I create something extraordinary for people versus how can I create something that drive the growth, the business growth of the company? It's very different. Obviously, the business growth of the company needs to be an imperative, a priority, but there is a slight difference in culture between people that think, I'm going to create something amazing for other people out there, and I'm going to use this company to do that. And I believe that if I do that, I'm going to create value, business value for the company too. So I drive human value to build business value versus people that think, I'm going to drive business value and I'm going to see human value as a potential lever of this, but it's not necessary because I could drive business value through scale, through barriers to entry, through patents and technologies. So this is the first shift, human centricity in a world where those barriers to entry made of scale of production, distribution, and communication are crumbling down under the winds of globalization, new technologies, and mostly digitization. So,
I agree.
People out there can come up with an idea and go compete with the big brands and the big companies in ways that they couldn't before, leveraging the digital world.
I agree.
So this is the first shift. Be human-centered, and it's not about processes and tools and ways of working, it's culture. The second component is the first set of people in the sentence, the people loving. And so after in the book talking about the need of human-centricity, how the world is changing and why you need that human-centricity, and proposing a series of tools and methodologies to do it, what we call as designers, design thinking. So the ability to combine desirability, feasibility, and viability to create meaningful solutions for people. So it's people, technology, and business. That's what design thinking is about. And then you prototype around the three dimensions, so you create something extraordinary for people. After I talk about this in the first part of the book, at a certain point I'm like, okay, if this is true, you can take these tools, these methodologies, and you can apply them to any company, and you're going to be extremely successful. And the reality is that this is not the case. It's not just about the tools and the methodologies. You need the right people behind those tools and methodologies. And too many times, instead, companies just talk about the processes. You go to an innovation firm, a design firm, a marketing firm, and they sell you their brand name and their tools and what they do. And then within the company or with the firm, if you work with certain people, you will have certain kind of results. If you work with other people, you will have completely different kind of results.
Agreed.
So years ago, I came to the realization that for me to build design in 3M and then later on in PepsiCo, the most important thing was not the tools, the methodologies, and the processes that was introduced into the company, the design-driven tools and methodologies. It was all about choosing the right people. And I came up with this a list of 24 characteristics of these unicorns, these innovation leaders, these people in love with people. And we talk about some of them. You know, again, dream, the ability to dream, to make things happen, curiosity, kindness, optimism, and many others. So the first set of these people in the people in love with people sentence is the unicorns, the people driving innovation and reminding everybody in the world that you need to be almost scientific, super strategic in the way you hire people, you grow them, you inspire them, you retain them. And you need to understand that curiosity and kindness and optimism are actually drivers of productivity, of excellence from a business standpoint, of business growth. And so too many times they are just qualities that people intuitively think sometimes, you know, they're useful. Other times, they even think that actually you don't want them in the company. Kindness is often seen as a synonym of weakness.
Yeah, exactly, right? Oh, yeah. Your company is kind. Why are you not so... I mean, for us, the one thing that we apply to all of our businesses and the businesses that we own is ask it. So we always hire and do performance management in this order: attitude, skill, knowledge, energy, experience, and timing. And you look at a job description on Indeed or any, the first thing they ask you, what's your experience? What's your knowledge? They don't talk about, is there a cultural fit? How many times have we gone and purchased an organization, a business, and you go, no, I don't want it. The books are clean. It's performing. And they're like, Martin, why do you guys not want to buy this business? The culture sucks. The culture is cutthroat. It's all about performance. It's all about the numbers. And if I step in there, I'm going to have eyes around my head to be able to make sure that I watch everything. So I'd rather buy a company that is in more financial difficulty because of lack of skill or knowledge or experience that we can bring to the table and we can grow them. But if the individual is curious, crystallizes thinking, asks a lot of questions, admits their wrongdoing, sees failure as an opportunity to grow, those key, I think your 24 kind of match our core values as well of getting shit done, really demonstrating care. With the right skills, they will gain the experience and knowledge. As long as they have the energy and they've got the time to do it, those are kind of environmental criticalities that are different than the individual. But I'm with you 110%. You know, good process is important when you have good people. The good process is a game changer only if you have good people. Because if you don't have good people, look at the law today. We think that the law is, you know, people break laws all the time. People kind of divert laws. People do this, do that. They don't follow the process because they're not necessarily good people. So in an organization, I am 100% with you on the people who love the people.
Yeah. And by the way, then you just mentioned it again. The third component is the law. And the law somehow summarizes most of the 24 traits of these people, you know, we people of these unicorns, is the love for the people you serve, for your consumers, your customers. I like to call them people, human beings.
Yeah, of course.
I like to call them for what they are. So it's really caring about creating something extraordinary for them. Is the love for what you do, is the love I was mentioning at the beginning of this conversation that I witness in my parents, in everything they were doing every day. So it's that passion that drives you through all kinds of difficulties to get over anything to arrive to your dream. And then is the love for the people surrounding you, is your team, is your peers, is, you know, the entire organization, because you want to bring people with you. And this is so important. We don't live anymore in the world of a one woman or one man show. You need a cross-functional team, simply because if you believe in this idea of extreme excellence, when you need the best of the best in all dimensions of a product or a brand, then by definition, you need the best marketers, the best designers, the best engineers, the best finance people to help you creating that excellence. And therefore, you need a series of characteristics in these people to enable collaboration, teamwork, to help them working together in the best possible way. Love summarizes it all, but it's kindness, it's respect, is, you know, a series of characteristics, is humbleness. But this humbleness combined with confidence, a series of characteristics that build the glue of the team and make the team, you know, super powerful.
One thing that, you know, just because we're saying love and happiness doesn't mean that there's not conflict. And healthy conflict is important. One thing that, you know, instead of having a people conflict, when you have an organization of love, is you have task conflict. Your opinion, democracy was built on difference of opinion. And that's how creativity, often at times, as you pull things apart, you kind of unravel certain things that, you know, you didn't see, I didn't see, but by us pulling on either side, we're like, oh, look at that. Look at what the beauty of this thing, you know, elasticized. When I see glass blowers, for example, you look at the process of melting, undoing, revisiting, you know, bending, cutting. And then all of a sudden you see this glass blown horse that has come from all this hardship, manipulation, pulling, tugging, blowing. You're like, wow. And yeah, that's a thing. But in today's day, virtual, that digitalization, like I bought my first NFT for the first time. It is something built. It is something, although you can't touch it, it is a product. And that's something that we have to come to realize in this day and age, that productization doesn't have to be always tangible, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, you talk about conflict. I prefer to call it dialogue, but I totally understand the point you are making, the fact that it's not kindness is and love is not a driver just of be nice to each other and everything happen. You need attention as well, but it needs to be healthy. And this is where other characteristics of the unicorns that I talk about. So in the book, in each of these characteristics, you know, there are pages and pages to describe them, why they're meaningful to a company. So in this specific case, you need respect. Mm-hmm. It's so important. You need the empathy to understand the other person. You need the ability to be a storyteller so that you can communicate what is important to you, your message, in a way that is inspiring and appealing to people. You need the ability to be a polyglot, a cultural polyglot, understanding how to talk the language of the other counterpart. So you need a series. Too many times people on purpose put, like CEOs and business leaders, put people under them in conflict with each other, but they don't make sure that there are a series of characteristics to have a healthy conflict. And this conflict becomes instead a driver of lack of productivity. You need conflict, but you need a series of characteristics like respect, empathy,
trust,
have a healthy kind of conflict.
Agreed. I think a difference of opinion, again, is not, I use the word conflict, but I agree with you. It might be too intense. Having a difference of opinion is critical in analyzing and turning something which is a single view, one direction, in something that is four directional, right? That has multiple aspects to it. And I think that that creativity comes through discussion. I always say it is important for everybody within the team to be seen, to be heard, and they know that they matter. Too many times in business, we tend to say, well, what's the objective? The journey is more important. If you do everything right on a day-to-day basis, then the result will be good. And I think the one thing that I absolutely love about the word, how you use love, and I think it's underused, is that love is consistent. Love is every day. I think of somebody who loves somebody, who people who've been married for 40 years plus. You change the word lust to love. Right? Lust is intense. It's good, but it's short. And too many businesses think like that. Oh, we need to get market shares. You know, we need to grow the business. We need the people to lust this project, where the success comes from love, right? Which I think the word is so powerful when you think about it, and so applicable to, do you love yourself? Do you love your job? Do you love the people that you work with? It's just a very powerful four-letter word that can be applied to so many different things.
Yeah. You need to do the effort then to specify what you mean with love. Yes, that's why I had this need of writing an entire book about this, because it's so easy to misread the idea of love, to dismiss it because it's like, oh, it's too romantic. Come on. What does it have to do with business? Or to give it meanings that eventually are important, but they're not comprehensive of everything love may mean in a business. But the beauty is that the word is synthesized it all. It is. But once you explain what you talk about, people are going to be like, yes, I get it. I drive it. And they love it, as you say. They love the word love. Because at the end of the day, We have it inside ourselves. You know, it's an instinct that we have. We want to be that kind of people, even though we're bombarded by bad news all the time and we see hate and conflict all the time in social media. And eventually, even in companies, we use metaphors of war and winning, fighting with others. But at the end of the day, individually, we love the idea of love. We want to be nice. We want to be kind. You know, the more I talk about these values, you know, because of the book or because of the speeches I've been doing in the past few months and years, the more I see that people resonate with it. They want that. They're tired of not having that. They want love in their life. They don't have enough love in their life. And by the way, we spend so much time at work in the office, virtual or physical that it is right now. If we don't have love there, if we're not happy there, then our life is going to be miserable. Not our professional life, our life, because we spend so much time working. That is a big chunk of our life. Happiness at work should be a key driver for us individually and then for business leaders, CEOs, and companies of any kind. It's so important. It is, by the way, for ethical reasons. It's important for society. It's important for the world. It's important for us as human beings. But that is important also for your company because it's a driver of excellence, of productivity. It inspires people. It makes them work with such a more effectiveness in what they do. It's so powerful. And yet it's not that practiced yet.
If somebody wants to be at work, the work will always be quality. Right? Yeah. I always my good friend of mine, we spend time in the south of France, Antibes, which is close to Cannes. And this one time we went to the baker shop and with my daughter. And I said, "Sir, how long have you been a baker?" And he says with a French accent, "Well, my father was a baker and my grandfather was a baker." Because my daughter said, "This is the best baguette I've ever had in my life. Ever, ever, ever." I said, "Well, this is France, right?" And he said, "Oh, no, but not everywhere in France, right?" He says, "I love my baguettes. I make them with love. Like I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. My father woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. My grandfather woke up at, you know, and the sourdough base that they had was from the time of Napoleon." It's like, you have to love what you do to be able, and it you can taste the love in the baguette, right? And so I think too many of us, especially in North America, we've adopted this kind of quick and easy get rid of kind of mentality where more is better, where actually less is better and quality is utmost of importance. And we've lost a lot of quality. I don't want to take anything away from Amazon and the Chinese market. That's far from it. But we've tend to use and abuse stuff instead of saying, well, do I really need it now? And if I do need it now, then why not buy something of quality that's going to add value, that's going to make me happy? And oftentimes too many, we consume in very unqualitative state, I guess.
But let me share a story. And let me tell up front that I have the greatest respect and admiration for the American culture. I became an American citizen. I work for an American company. But I see weaknesses and strengths in every culture, in the American one, in the Italian one, and many other cultures that I witness, you know, all around the world. So I want to talk about something that I think is somehow a weakness of this culture, even though often it's perceived as a strength. I came here from Italy and I bought a house in Minnesota when I was working at 3M, and I gutted the house completely and I redesigned all the interiors. Before doing that, completely by coincidence, 1 year and a half before, I did exactly the same thing in my house in Italy. I was not expecting to leave Italy and move. So I just did it there. And so here I arrive in Minnesota, fresh of the experience of doing the same redesign and restructuring project, you know, a year and a half before in Italy. And so I arrive and I start to meet all these the contractors and the different people,
the trades,
people putting the tiles and putting people putting the shower and the fireplace. And by the way, I decided to do a lot of work of coordination by myself without getting a general contractor, working directly with all these people.
Yeah.
So here they arrive and they're like, wow, they sell me their service in an amazing way. Mm-hmm. I realized later on that actually this is something they teach you at school already, you know, very young. In America, they teach you to present. They teach you to storytell. It's part of the education. In Italy, you don't. You study, you get the knowledge and everything, but they don't teach you to be on stage and present as you do in America. In America, they understand how important it is. This is branding. This is storytelling. This is the the great marketing culture of America. So great. I mean, it's very useful. I learned over years how important it is. So here I am there. I'm like, wow, there is such a gap with Italy. This is going to be amazing. And then here we are, they start to do the work and it's a disaster. But basic things like aligning the tiles, you know, on the floor, and then they were going up to the tub and the tub on the side of these tiles, and you wanted the line on the floor to follow, you know,
to match them,
or they attach the shower in the wrong way, they put the fireplace upside down. I mean, all kinds of things, but it's not one, you know, that you have bad luck and you're bad. No, it happened over and over again. I realized later on in Italy, they had no clue how to sell their craft. They're not storytellers at all. But they loved what they were doing. And they were ready to not make too much money, to lose profit, to because they care about the craft and the result. And they will spend more time eventually, maybe making a little bit less money. But they were proud of the job done right.
Agreed.
What I witnessed in America is something that often happens. The idea is my pride comes from, I'm going to make money here. I'm going to make as much money as possible. I'm going to work as fast as possible. I'm going to, you know, ask, you know, connect with a series of people that can help me. I need to do this job and move on to the next job. That is completely different. And now I'm not saying that every American is like this. Of course, I'm not saying that every Italian is good at doing, you know. But in general, you know the Italian tradition in fashion, in interior design. There is the culture of love and care that is so important. And my message in the book actually is about this. You do need the incredible ability of America of storytelling, of branding. Italy needs it desperately. So you need that. But you also need the love, the care for what you do, the passion, the idea of, okay, I'm going to create the best possible result with my job for the person I'm serving instead of I'm going to make money and move and hopefully the job is good enough for this person to call me again next time.
Yeah.
It's a huge, huge cultural shift that is necessary. Essentially, what I'm saying is that both cultures need to learn from each other. The Italian culture need to learn the ability to storytell and market and branding of America. America should look at the passion and love for the craft. You know, now it's Italy. You mentioned France with the baguette.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, by the way, and I, because I'm very respectful of the American culture and I'm an American citizen and my daughter is born here in the U.S., there are tons of people that have that love here. I'm not, I don't want to generalize, but in general, often branding, storytelling, and profit comes before the care and the love for what we do.
The success is attached to dollars and not quality of work, right?
Yeah, often, not always, but
often. When you, and I think also the vastness of the country as well. You know, when I think about Italy, you have maybe, in a village, you'll have maybe one or two carpenters and, you know, they might go a little bit further, but they know, you know who the carpenter is. And if the carpenter doesn't do a good job, his future is completely done. Cause you know, you'll say, hey, don't work with Dominic cause Dominic's not a good tiler. Right. And so and there's also the aspect of history, I think, in my opinion, because the history of North America is drawn from the Western drive, right? You had to be a master of all trades when you went from east to west. You had chuck wagons. You had to be able to defend yourself. You had to build a house. You had to build a church. You had to raise. So the multifaceted individual was the most successful in often at times through the 1800s. That's the history of, you know, the U.S. and Canada as we moved west. But I think that the time of the pioneer is long gone. Now the country is established. And I think that the quality of living and operations of what you do needs to come back, not just in the United States, but as a whole in the world. It's not a one and done. I think that if we want to have a sustainable impact on the planet, either with people and the planet, we have to be mindful of the quality of work and the quality of day that we have day in, day out. And I think it just kind of comes kind of full circle with love. I think your title is just so bang on, right? And love the people. Oh my goodness. It's just, so two more questions. What pushed you to write the book? What was the event that you said, okay, I got to write a book on this? What's that critical timing?
Love, once again. And let me explain. First of all, I wanted to be a writer since I was a kid or an artist. Mm-hmm. I started the book talking about this is real. I always knew I wanted to mm-hmm. write a book. So I started to take notes over the years, thinking sooner or later that would become a book. And I realized later that the passion was not just for writing or for art. I realized that my passion, my love, was for the art of storytelling. So I love to be on stage at conferences, to have conversations like the one we're having right now. I just have this instinct of sharing, similar mm-hmm. to the one of my parents in their own ways. And so I had this instinct all the time. I prepare myself, and I had the material for this book now for 10 years. Wow. But two things needed to happen. One was I needed to gain with years and experience more and more and more clarity on what I had in mind. So for instance, the last 10 years in PepsiCo have been very important for me to learn so much and validate certain things and everything. The other thing was that I didn't need to write a book about what I was doing in PepsiCo for business reasons. I didn't need that. And therefore, the reason why I wanted to write a book was to enjoy the journey of writing the book.
I
wanted to enjoy that because I love, you know, writing the book. Like you enjoy painting. You don't think, oh, it's time in my life to do a painting. No, you love painting. And so I love writing. I've been writing all my life. And in fact, I'm super active in social media, in LinkedIn, in Instagram, in Facebook. And I've been since the invention of social media. So I've been writing every day. I post every day and I write. If you check my post, there is a lot of writing. So it's a passion. But to enjoy, I needed to be ready in my mind, in my soul, mm-hmm. in my heart. So I needed some form of peace of mind and stability that was given to me by the encounter of with Carlotta, my partner, the stability we reached together, the idea of having a baby together. So we started to work on the baby. The baby now is born in 7 months, almost 7 months old. Also the stability of a certain kind of credibility in PepsiCo, you know, moving from startup phase to scale up phase and the company understand the value of design, it is embracing it and driving it. So I was like, okay, I'm in peace. I closed the loop of one of those seasons you were talking about and I'm ready, you know, for the next season. But is a good moment to enjoy the writing of this book. And also, beautiful. You know, the book is so important because one thing is to take notes. The other thing is when you really need to put everything together in a real book. And that's a process that helps you to analyze yourself, psychoanalyze yourself. And then you put the book out there and you start to receive feedback. And that's so useful as well because it's feedback on you, what you think, and it helps you learning and growing and validating ideas and eventually, you know, going over some other ideas or evolving them in something else. The feedback I'm receiving for the book, for instance, about certain values like kindness, optimism, curiosity is mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect that so much. And it's making me realize that I need to be even more an ambassador of those kind of values, because people out there, they want them. And I have a platform. I have hundreds of thousands of followers in, you know, the multiple social media. So I need to push this more and more and more, because there is millions of people out there that want executives like me to pitch this idea. And absolutely, I have multiple friends at CEO level, you know, renowned people out there that somehow practice this idea, but they don't talk about them. And we need more people, more CEOs to talk about the power of their kindness and their optimism and their curiosity. And now it's changing the game, because that is going to give permission, not just to their own employees that eventually already know, but to millions of people out there to practice those kind of values, to practice the love, you know, that encompass everything else we've been talking about today.
Mauro, you just sold what CEOs talk about. It's exactly the purpose of this podcast, right? Is to open the door to say, hey, listen, CEOs don't have conversations behind closed doors. It's just, we are often, although we are public, we have all these thoughts in our heads that it's not that we don't want to share them. Is because we are discussing these and taking notes down and writing these things down together. And I think that that's one of the things that I appreciate about what we do and having gentlemen and people like you, is to say they're not out of reach. Although you think that there's a negative connotation against CEO or chief design or chief creative officer, there are human beings that just have lots of followers. Just listen to truly what they have to say. They're not out there to rape and pillage and to make all the profits in the world. They're actually there to use their influence to make good in the world. I think that's thank you. Thank you for that. Last questions.
Yeah.
So what is the one book, one movie, one piece of reference that has made Mauro who Mauro is today? What have you gone back to numerous times in case of doubt, when you're thinking, when you're struggling, or when you're in a good place, that you read or reread?
I am always inspired by the biographies of great thinkers and people that changed the world. And there are a few that I love particularly. One is the biography of Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, as well as the work of Walter Isaacson on other biographies, like the one of Einstein, the one of Leonardo da Vinci. Then two books that I love deeply are the two biographies of Richard Branson, Losing My Virginity and Finding My Virginity. The biography of Phil Knight, the founder of Nike. The book is called Shoes Dog. These are some of the ones that I love the most, because they mix real life and you feel and witness the passion of these people with the struggles and their challenges and what they got over to arrive to where they arrived. And so every time I close a book like this, I finish a book like this, I'm like, wow, I'm gonna, you know, first of all, I feel like I'm not doing anything. I should do so much more. But I'm an optimistic and a positive thinker. So I transform that thinking in energy. Like, okay, let's do more then.
Yeah, right. So for me, I always say there's no man or woman that is above or below me. Meaning that if somebody else did it, why the hell can I not do it? Right? Yeah. What are you ready and willing to do? And oftentimes, the word sacrifice comes along and I say, you know, people have said, oh, you're very successful with your podcast. And this, what have you sacrificed? I said, well, when you're happy, I haven't really sacrificed anything. There's certain things though we understand sometimes when you're starting a business or people think, oh, you're giving away some of your family time to do business time. But yeah, sometimes it is to have more family time, right? I'm spending more time at the office so I can spend more time with my family, playing rugby, traveling the world and stuff like that. So I hear you and I appreciate that, because oftentimes we just read the biography in a story versus what's the learning opportunity? And I think that that's what you're telling people is, hey, when you are reading these biographies, view it as a recipe book. Hey, here's what they've done. Here's how they've done it. So yeah. Good. That's a good one. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to have to say goodbye because I think my voice is going down, 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 down. Amaro, thank you so very much. Can you show the book, please? Can you give us, because all the details will be at the bottom of the episode.
Let me find the book. I have my dog here with me on the table.
There
you go. Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People in Love with People.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. So all the details will be on the show episode below. I think, you know what? I'd love for are your parents' books still available?
They are in Italian though, but they're poems combined with paintings and sketches. Yes.
We are totally available. All that. Let's put those links down there. I want the world to see Mauro's parents' work at heart because they define who you are, that's for sure. And the way that you're influencing the world, it's a good influence to have. So
thank you.
With that being said, my name is Martin Hunter. I am the host of What CEOs Talk About, where today we translated really what does love look like on a day-to-day basis and how can you live it all the way through. So with that, enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you at the next one. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to What CEOs Talk About. Make sure to click subscribe to get notified about future episodes or check us out at www.whatceostalkabout.com.